A famous line of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice." The origin of this line was by a Unitarian minister, Theodore Parker, born in 1810. According to the Unitarian Universalist History and Heritage Society, Parker was a preacher, lecturer, and writer, a public intellectual, and a religious and social reformer. He played a major role in moving Unitarianism away from being a Bible-based faith, and he established a precedent for clerical activism that has inspired generations of liberal religious leaders. Now, the origin of Dr. King's line came from a collection of 10 sermons of religion by Parker in 1857, and it actually said this: "Look at the facts of the world. You see a continual and progressive triumph of the right," and I don't think he meant at that time the right. "I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one. My eye reaches but little ways. I cannot calculate the curve and complete the figure by the experience of sight. I can divine it by conscience. From what I see, I am sure it bends towards justice." Parker was an amazing figure in UU history and in Transcendentalism, and I would recommend that you look him up for further study if you haven't. But perhaps the major thing he's remembered for, and the thing that all UU ministers have to study in order to be UU ministers, is a sermon titled "The Transient and Permanent in Christianity." And this is a benchmark piece of work that had a significant influence on the course and direction of Unitarianism, and one of the reasons that we're all sitting here today in a Unitarian Universalist congregation, or that we're allowed to sit here today. Again, from the Unitarian Universalist History and Heritage Society, Parker emerged as a Transcendentalist spokesman in 1841 when he delivered a discourse on the transient and permanent in Christianity at an ordination in South Boston. Parker intended the main point of the sermon to be that Jesus preached the absolute religion. What made the strongest impression on Parker's audience, however, was his vehement denial of the factuality of biblical miracles and of the miraculous authority of both the Bible and Jesus. Particularly outraged were three Trinitarian guests in the audience. They published an attack on the sermon in the newspapers. I wish anyone would notice my sermons enough to publish an attack in the newspapers. And demanded to know if Unitarians considered Parker a Christian minister. During the resulting uproar, most Unitarian ministers and a large portion of the Unitarian lay public concluded that Parker's theology was not Christian. And just like Emerson, who had been banned from Harvard Divinity School for his heretical views that challenged the Unitarian orthodoxy of the times, Parker was in the theological doghouse with the mainstream of Unitarians. I'm going to read you a little bit about what he said that was so amazing. "Looking at the word of Jesus, at real Christianity, the pure religion he taught, nothing appears more fixed and certain. Its influence widens as light extends. It deepens as nations grow more wise. But looking at the history of what men call Christianity, nothing seems more uncertain and perishable. While true religion is always the same thing, in each century, in each land, each person that feels it, the Christianity of the pulpit, which is religion that is taught, the Christianity of the people, which is the religion that is accepted and lived out, has never been the same thing in two centuries on any lands, except only in name." And he says, "Let us look at this matter a little more closely. In actual Christianity, that is, in the portion of Christianity which is preached and believed, there seem to have been, ever since the time of its earthly founder, two elements. One is the transient, and the other is the permanent. The one thought is, the one is the thought, the folly, the uncertain wisdom, the theological notions, the impiety of man, and the other is the eternal truth of God, he says. These two bear perhaps the same relation to each other that the phenomena of outward nature, such as sunshine and clouds, growth, decay, reproduction, bear to the great law of nature, which underlies and supports them all. What I think Parker was getting at is that he believed there was a core truth of religion, which was permanent and unchangeable. And the way it had been used and interpreted since it was created was always changing, not changing necessarily in good ways, but more in a way that met the needs of those who changed it, and changed it away, in his belief, from the original intent. This meant it had to be examined, it had to be explored, and it was always important to be searching for a way back to the core meaning. Now, Unitarian Universalists have questioned orthodoxy and convention for a very long time. That's why a little bell goes off in my head when I hear the phrase, "But we've always done it this way." Because one of the things Parker is educating us about is the way it's always been is rarely the way it's always been. It may be the way we've come to know it, but it may have come from a series of evolutions or events that now, that form certain things in a certain way that may never have been done intentionally. But now, all of a sudden, they're part of our tradition. I'm not saying that tradition is all bad. Traditions can be wonderful. They can be grounding. They can inform people and cultures to important aspects of their history and shared meaning. But it doesn't mean that they shouldn't be explored or examined. There's a very important tradition that I observed as a child. It was about the discovering of America. In school, the way it was always done was to know the date of 1492 when Columbus sailed the ocean blue. We all know it, right? We all know it. But that doesn't mean that it was a wonderful thing, because generations were taught about the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, but what they weren't taught was about the doctrine of discovery. Now, the doctrine of discovery is a principle of international law dating back to the late 15th century. It has its roots in a papal decree issued by Pope Nicholas V in 1452 that specifically sanctioned and promoted the conquest, colonization, and exploitation of non-Christian territories and peoples. Hundreds of years of decisions and laws continuing right up to our own time, as recently as, I believe, a Supreme Court case in 2001, I'm not sure about that, but I'm pretty sure, have been traced back to this specific papal decree of a doctrine of discovery. Laws that invalidate or ignore the rights, sovereignty, and humanity of indigenous peoples in the United States and around the world. And as the UUA has noted, the reason the Unitarian Universalist Association has noted, the reason this matters is because the doctrine of discovery is woven into the fabric of the United States via 19th century case law that's still used as a precedent, and it's still a basis for courts today in violating existing treaties with Native peoples and taking away mineral and water rights. I don't think that this papal decree of the Pope Nicholas was the original Christianity that Jesus preached. So it wasn't always done this way. But it's been done this way now for a very long time. As children, we were taught many things about the native peoples of this land, but it certainly wasn't taught to us from their perspective. And now, as awareness grows around the impact of this history to native communities, according to the year 2000 census data, a Native American born today, compared to all other ethnicities and races, has a 50% chance that they'll never finish high school, has an 86% chance they'll never obtain a college degree, is 2.5 times more likely to be a victim of violence than any other ethnicity, is 80% more likely to die a violent death by accident, murder, or suicide. One in three Native women will be raped or sexually assaulted at least once. 86% of perpetrators are non-Native, causing jurisdiction issues and no prosecution. There's a lower life expectancy, 10 years lower than the national average. It's 2.5 times greater a chance of committing suicide before the age of 24. And 3 times more likely to suffer an illness, diabetes, heart disease, or cancer. Theodore Parker saw slavery as the greatest obstacle to achieving democracy. He denounced the Mexican War from 1846 to 1848 as an attempt to expand slavery and led Boston opposition to the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. The act established a federal bureaucracy to catch slaves who had escaped from free states. Most Boston Unitarian ministers either refused to oppose the legislation or publicly supported it as a constitutional obligation and as politically necessary concession to the South in order to save the Union. Some argue that catching fugitive slaves were sanctioned by Scripture. Parker pronounced the act a violation of Christian ideals and a threat to free institutions, and he called for it openly to be defied. There are all kinds of ways that we have done things in our lives and at work and in our communities, in our congregations and around the world that are always the way we think it's been done. Whether they've grown into something that corrupts the original intent or conversely have come straight from a long-established tradition, the way things have always been done needs fresh air, needs light, needs examination. I think it would be unfair to me to compare some cherished tradition of ours here at UUFSD to slavery or the doctrine of discovery. I'm thinking, for instance, coffee hour wouldn't be on the same level. But just for fun, let's take coffee hour as a more practical example of an organizational tradition that needs examination. I guess we could get rid of coffee hour, but then maybe we wouldn't talk at all after the service. I guess we could expand coffee hour to be a catered meal every week for sale, but then it would be a lot more like a restaurant. It's been suggested that we have some espresso carts here with pastries for sale, and we get a percentage of the take with more choices of coffee. That's a pretty good one, actually. These are all ways to think about transforming coffee hour, ways that are all transient and ways that change the way that it's always been done. But I think it's also important to look at what the permanent is in coffee hour or the questions that lie at the core. For instance, what should we do after our service that gives people a chance to talk, to connect, and share this important Sunday experience in a meaningful way? Or how can we transform our Sundays together to be opportunities of healing, wholeness, and transformation? And what would that look like if we weren't bound to having coffee and eating carbohydrates on the patio? What if something happened here on Sundays and between services and after services that fed you so deeply, that connected you so completely, that transformed the way you approached your life so much that no one cared if we ever drank coffee again? I would tell you what would happen. Some would leave because they missed the taste and simplicity of coffee. And others would come because they are looking for whatever replaced it that brought that deeper sense of connection and transformation. I'm not attacking coffee. As most of you know, I love a good cup of decaf, and I certainly enjoy a nosh on the patio between services. What I'm saying is that we come from a long line of people who have challenged the way things have always been. We are planted firmly in a faith tradition that offers challenges, that often challenges the meaning of faith and often challenges the meaning of tradition. It can be unsettling, but I also think it can help us look at the structures and systems of injustice. It can help us overcome complacency and fear. It can move us into new creative directions. It can help us understand what holds us back and what helps us move to our growing edges. I don't think it's helpful or useful to be questioning all traditions all the time, and I want to remind us that sometimes we question them and discover that they're exactly what they need to be. Some of you may remember New Coke. But I guess the point is, we shouldn't be afraid to question them, to examine them, and to decide if they are still meeting our core purpose. At the 2012 General Assembly in Phoenix, delegates of the Unitarian Universalist Association passed a resolution repudiating the doctrine of discovery and calling on Unitarian Universalists to study the doctrine and eliminate its presence from current-day policies, programs, theologies, and structures of Unitarian Universalism. It said, "Be it resolved that we, the delegates of the 2012 General Assembly of the Unitarian Universalist Association, repudiate the doctrine of discovery as a relic of colonialism, feudalism, and religious, cultural, and racial biases having no place in the modern-day treatment of indigenous peoples." And then, much like Parker did with regard to slavery, the UUA states, "As a people of faith, we are called to understand and dislodge the doctrine of discovery and its present-day effects and advocate for our government to fully implement the UN Declaration on Rights of Indigenous Peoples as an aspirational declaration passed by the United Nations in 2007 and to which the United States became signed in 2010. We are human, and we are comfortable in patterns. But sometimes those patterns need changing, need evolution, need fresh air, and in some cases we need to look at the facts of the world. And although we may see a continual and progressive triumph of what is right, we cannot pretend to always understand the moral universe. For the arc is a long one, and our eyes can only reach but a little ways. We may not be able to calculate the curve and complete the figure by the experience of sight. But if we search deep enough, we might be able to divine it by conscience. And if we keep working on it together, we hope it will always bend towards justice. May that be so.